Chapter 46. The Morass of Paris. Lloyd George arrived in Paris at the beginning of January, 1919, flanked by a retinue of emirs, maharajas and prime ministers from Canada, New Zealand, Australia and all the other far-flung outposts of the British Empire. Clemenceau suspected perfidious Albion, had once more double-crossed the French, and said as much to Lloyd George, "The very next day after the armistice I have found you to be the enemy of France." Lloyd George replied, "Well, isn't it our traditional policy?" The altercation reflected British policy without embellishment. France had replaced Germany as the enemy. Although Clemenceau was able to establish that Britain was the enemy, he was unable to see that only a reconciliation with Germany prevented him from developing such a thought. This ignorance was shared by many of his compatriots and was always cleverly exploited by the British establishment. Before 1914, most Frenchmen lived in total ignorance of all their neighbors. They traveled little because they were satisfied no country could match their own. The famous author Charles Maurras had only once in his lifetime left France, and that was to take, as a young man, a short train trip to Brussels. Pierre Laval, a cabinet minister 11 times, told me he had also been in Belgium by train, but I did not see anything because my train was going to Berlin where I had been invited by Stresemann, and it was dark. Clemenceau knew so little about anything foreign he could not distinguish between Dutch and Belgian currency. This could be understandable coming from overseas visitors, but France had lived next to these foreigners for more than 2,000 years. Thus was post-war Europe poisoned by British perfidy and French hatred and ignorance. Petty squabbles were the order of the day. It was such an environment that Wilson would reach Paris on January 14, 1918. He bore his hallowed 14 points as if he had come down from Sinai with them. He was sure they would illuminate the world. He was quite prophet-like about it. For Clemenceau, the 14 points were just so much airy nonsense. He would not say so publicly, however, and instead set out the welcome mat for Wilson. He organized a favorable press and arranged for French academician Lavedin to write. "We saw him in Illustration, a famous magazine, we have admired him and our descendants will admire him. President Wilson will appear in the poetry of the coming centuries like Dante, whom he resembles in profile. The future generations will see him leading, between the perils of this infernal world, the Beatrice dressed in white which we call peace. We salute in our hearts, in the temple of our gratitude, this eternally memorable man. Hail President Wilson, High Priest of Idealism." Left-wing author Romain Rolland was not about to be outpuffed and threw in his own lofty encomium. "Heir to Washington and Abraham Lincoln, convoke the Congress of Humanity. Be the arbiter of all free people. And may the future generations call thee the reconciliator." While incense was lavishly dispensed, Clemenceau was preparing to neutralize Wilson's points. Like the British, he had come to resent American success. There was plain jealousy and also a feeling that American growth would create a new center of power. Both the British and Clemenceau believed that their respective countries should be the center of the world and disliked the idea of a new contender. Allied anti-Americanism was really scandalous. The Entente had railroaded America into a war that was none of her business. The wheat and steel the Allies had received from America saved them from defeat, and American soldiers saved them from annihilation. The Allies often charged that the United States was obsessed with business, and undoubtedly American business had benefited from the war. But after all, businessmen are out to seize opportunities and to make a profit. No one had forced the Allies to buy from America. The Germans would have jumped at the chance had they not been blockaded. Clemenceau wrote, "America, for a relatively small loss of lives, would materially benefit at our expense out of all proportions, greatness and misery," page 158. In comparison to French or German losses, it may have been small, but it was 100,000 American men, dead in a war of no concern to them. Clemenceau also resented the fact he had been helped. It was a matter of pride; he would have liked to have won the war all by himself. Apart from matters of pride, ignorance, and ingratitude, there was also a fundamental difference of ideology. Clemenceau's ideas of self-determination had little to do with Wilson's 14 points. "We must have the courage to say it, we did not go into war with a program of liberators," he said. Before reaching Europe, Wilson had let known his misgivings to his associates: "The men with whom we are going to negotiate do not represent the opinion of their people." In fact, few of the Versailles conventioners represented their own people. The latest Senate elections were a virtual denial of the Americans' previous mandate for Wilson. Clemenceau would, within a few months, be trounced in the French presidential election. Venizelos had been thrown out by his Greek people. Erzberger, the unfortunate German signatory of the armistice, would be assassinated, a victim of German outrage. The British were continuing their divide-and-rule policy. The French, blinded by their hatred of Germany, were locked in obscurantist policies. The Germans were treated as pariahs. And there was in addition a horde of creditor nations who had hopped on the war bandwagon against Germany at the last minute and demanded their share of the spoils. Versailles was a hornet's nest of quarrelsome and conniving mediocrities. Clemenceau called it a peace full of treacheries, just like the ambushes of war. Churchill called it a squabble of pygmies, and at least on this matter both were right.